afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for Monday, April 29th. We have several public hearings today and work sessions, but because we have some members that would like to testify, we will start with our public hearing. And the first one up is I will open up a public hearing on HJM 7. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Joint Memorial 7 urges Congress to increase investment in Drinking Water State Revolving Fund and Clean Water State Revolving Fund to upgrade and repair public water and wastewater systems.
Great. Thank you. And we have my state representative here, so go easy on him this morning or this afternoon. Welcome, Representative Denbrough.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Michael Denbrough. I represent House District 45. That's Northeast Portland, out to Park Rose, with the city within a city of Maywood Park in between. And yes, please go easy on me. The representative is not the senator. Actually, it's a real pleasure to bring you House Joint Memorial 7. Because it's this really is a bill or a memorial that not only does good things, but it also is a feel-good kind of memorial. It addresses at the same time the need for better public health, more jobs, more resources for cash-strapped rural small towns, and the environment. What it does is it urges Congress to increase investment in state revolving loan funds that support fixed-rate, low-interest loans to communities for repairing and upgrading their public drinking water and wastewater systems. And it also asks Congress to provide dedicated funding for updating and repairing drinking water systems in schools. This program used to be a grant program in Congress, and then it became a loan program. We wish it were still a grant program, but even as a loan program, it does tremendous good for a number of particularly small towns around the country. You have a handout that we distribute, and if you look on the back side, you'll see a list of some of the recent loan recipients. And starting with the city of Tillamook and going down to the Tumalo Irrigation District, projects that really could not have been done without the benefit of this loan program. There's a clear consensus from stakeholders across the board that more federal investment really is needed for these loan programs. Again, Congress is unlikely to provide revenue to do a grant program, but they can, with some real pushing, ramp up their loan program. Congressman Blumenauer is supportive. I think a number of our delegation will be supportive if we go on record urging this memorial. The committee vote and the vote on the House floor were unanimous. There's a lot of support for this. We took testimony in favor of House Joint Memorial 7 from the Oregon AFL-CIO, AFSCME, League of Cities and Special Districts, Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors, Oregon Environmental Council, in addition to Food and Water Watch, who you'll hear from today, along with Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors. Colleagues, I urge your support of this memorial, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for bringing this forward. Actually, we only have Kate Newhall signed up, but we did receive written testimony that is on OLIS.
Okay,
so great. I just want to make sure that that's for the record. I just want to underscore some of the items that you mentioned. When I will say that when I was very young and the Clean Water Act passed, I was still in elementary school, but one of the things I do remember is because of the extra burden put on local communities having to comply with the Clean Water Act, the federal government provided millions and millions of dollars in grants. That was changed in, the early 80s to a loan program, revolving loan program. And so That is, in some ways, it's unfortunate because it still is a burden. Obviously, this has to be paid back, but they are low-interest loans. But as you can see, many of our communities, especially our smaller communities that don't have the rate base to offset these costs, is a very important program. I notice that Senator Hansel City is on this list, the city of Athena, which I just was fortunate enough to visit and stay at a couple of weeks ago. But it is a very important program, especially to smaller communities where they're not going to be able to pay this back through the rate base for a very long time. And so appreciate you bringing this forward. The other thing is that we often talk about infrastructure and creating jobs, and we tend to think about transportation infrastructure as our major source of jobs. Well, water and wastewater infrastructure is a huge part of, I think, a potential job creator in the state, and I would like us to see more federal dollars and certainly more state dollars going towards that. And so I appreciate you, again, making that a priority effort. So with that, we'll see if there's any additional comments or questions. Senator Hansel?
Well, I just have a comment. I know it was sampling of recent loan recipients that 30% of the list is from my district, including my hometown. So I can see the importance it is to rural Oregon, rural America, and it is a very important program. And I have no problem with encouraging our National Assembly to reauthorize it.
Great, thank you. And I should say that this was not a prearranged list.
I was wondering
House,
if you liked
the House side got the same list.
It was.
Yeah. Senator Olson, do you have a further comment or question?
Well, I just noticed that they looked down through there and they sucked him in. Representative Melrose, this is a good bill. The only question I have is these low interest loans, are they long term, like 20 years, 30 years? Or are they like more like in the 5 to 10 year range?
Actually, I'm not sure. Do you know, Beth? Sure. Do you?
We have the Department of Environmental Quality here that might be able to jump up. My guess is longer term, but Palmer, maybe you can illuminate for us the terms of the loan and typically what is a typical loan repayment?
Somehow I'd get Palmer up here.
Welcome, Palmer.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason, Government Relations Manager with DEQ. Yes, Senator Olson, I would be hugely disappointed if you didn't ask me a question. Unfortunately, I don't know that I can answer this question. I'll probably have to get you more information. I think we rarely make loans that are at a length of time close or at 20 years. So they tend to be shorter loans than that. I just don't know exactly how short and what the average length is, but I can certainly get you that information.
Follow up. So do you manage these loans?
We manage a part of what this memorial talks about. We manage this Clean Water State Revolving Loan Program. So we're making loans to local governments and water control districts for the purposes of wastewater treatment primarily, although some part of that money can be used for septic and stormwater as well.
Is the drinking water going through health, OHA?
Yes.
So what we have is a bifurcated program because you have the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. Mm-hmm. Dirty water goes through DEQ and clean water goes through public health.
We got the better end of the deal.
Yeah, it's going the right place.
Right. So, but we will, that's a good question. I just assumed that they were probably longer term loans, but I'm sure DEQ will be able to provide us with the
absolutely
the loan terms.
One follow up. Representative Dembro, this is really a good program, an important program for our state. What do you think the possibility of getting this expanded is, or just move through Congress?
Well, you know, Congress operates at its own pace. But I think it'll be important to have the support of our delegation, increasingly so. You know, I think as our delegation rises in seniority, we know that infrastructure challenges are, this is a national issue. This is not just an Oregon issue. And I think for Oregon to take the lead on this, I think will be very good.
Great. All right. Any other questions that Palmer can't answer?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I know that he'll get back to us because he always does. Okay, we actually, now because we stalled, we have two people that would like to testify on this. We have Kate Newhall and Julia DeGraw. Come on up. Kate, why don't you go ahead because you were on there first.
All right. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here on behalf of the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. PMCA represents over 200 contractors who employ over 3,000 people working throughout Oregon. We're here today to urge your support of this memorial and the additional federal investment in the Drinking Water State Fund and the Clean Water State Fund. As you just heard, Oregon's water infrastructure is in critical need of repair, upgrades, and continuing maintenance. The additional federal support for these two funds will safeguard public health, will make the necessary improvements, and put our contractors and their employees to work in communities throughout the state. With that, thank you for your time today, and I urge your support.
Great. Oh, we were just looking up, trying to look up the answer as we were talking Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Julia DeGraw, and I'm the Northwest Organizer for Food and Water Watch. We're a consumer advocacy organization based in D.C., but with regional offices throughout the United States and Europe and South America. So we are, or Latin America, so we are an international group. And we really focus on our most essential resources, food and water. It doesn't get a lot more essential than that. And nationally, we support a trust fund for reinvesting in America's water. I mean, it doesn't get much more crucial than making sure that people have access to clean, safe drinking water and sanitation. And unfortunately, since the 1970s, the amount of funding for our public water systems has really declined. It's gone down over 30%. And as the needs of these systems increase, whether it's with new regulation coming down from the EPA that helps us have cleaner, safer water, or whether it's just systems that are aging out, we have a system that requires more and more funding and is getting less and less from the federal government. And we think this is a really incredible opportunity to create a lot of jobs, especially in rural places throughout the United States and Oregon. And we're really excited to be to see this kind of development here at the Oregon State Legislature. And also, we have a delegation at the federal level that hopefully will be able to take a lead on really renewing America's water infrastructure. So it's really just a win-win situation in which we get jobs, clean, safe water for people, and it's just really exciting to see the support coming from the legislature. So thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thank you, ladies, for testifying. Any questions for either of these ladies? Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else would like to testify on HGM 7? Seeing none, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on HGM 7. Go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2247.
Yeah? Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2247 repeals the statutes regarding the GORS control account and repeals the statute requiring the use of agricultural experiment stations to eradicate algae and detrimental weeds and grasses from water, as well as the statute relating to the posting of cleaning requirements on certain agricultural machinery in weed-controlled districts. It authorizes an imposition of a civil penalty not to exceed $10,000 for a violation of weed control statutes.
Okay. Well, we have Lisa Hansen and Dan Hilburn to come educate us about what's the latest on GORS.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Dan Hilburn, our Program Manager for our plant health programs. Before you is a relatively simple bill that the department has brought forward, but it's an important bill to us. Back in 2009, ODA worked with the legislature to do a major rewrite of all of our plant laws, including our weed laws, to consolidate them and make them more usable. And so in that process, there were a few things left that needed to be cleaned up, and this bill represents what we hope to be the last of that plant law cleanup and rewrite. The bill is relatively simple. It repeals the statutes relating to the GORS account and the GORS program that is in statute with the ag experiment stations. However, in practice, that work is done by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. In addition, it repeals the responsibility for the ag experiment stations around the eradication of aquatic weeds. And today, most of that work is done by Portland State University with some funding coming from the state weed grant program. It also repeals a statute that requires county clerks to print a section of the law that is to be posted on farm equipment that talks about cleaning requirements for farm equipment. And so we believe that to be outdated, and it would eliminate that. And then finally, what we believe is a very important piece of this legislation. When we did the plant law cleanup in 2009, there was one section of the weed laws that had civil penalty authority and one section that didn't. And when we brought them together, that civil penalty authority was left behind. And so this reconnects the civil penalty authority with our weed control programs. So that's a quick summary of what's in the bill, and we're happy to answer any questions.
I have a quick one, which is, why was gorse, what was it brought here originally intended to do? I mean, was it ornamental? Was it, you know, I mean, I know we have a whole history on all of these invasive species, so if you can illuminate for me, because I know it's pervasive now and very hard to eradicate.
Yeah, Madam Chair, a very interesting story. Gorse was brought in as an ornamental to the Bandon area by the founder of Bandon.
Can you say your name, Dan?
I'm sorry, Dan Hilburn, plant program director for Oregon Department of Agriculture. So it's a very interesting story. Gorse is very highly flammable and was the reason that Bandon burned down some decades after it was brought in. And we're left to deal with that man's idea that gorse would be pretty in that part of the world.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. All right. Other questions? Senator Olson.
Did you ever, by chance, read the book on the founding of Bandon Dunes Golf Course and how they dealt with Scotch gorse?
I have not, no.
Rather interesting. They, on the first, on Bandon Dunes itself, they developed a machine like a street sweeper that would chain it all up and smash it all up, and then they'd burn it. And when they did Pacific Dunes, ironically enough, there was a fire that started because it burns very nicely. And that eradicated their problem quite nicely. So they didn't have to go through all the expense of doing it. But it's quite an interesting plant. And it is, once we remove this, how are we going to take care of it?
I was going to say we're being optimistic, Senator. once we remove it, yeah. Because
once we do this, this
fund. Oh, you're talking about that. I was
We do this fund, are we going to take care of the problem?
Yeah. Senator Olson, there hasn't been a gorse control account for many decades. As long as the institutional memory of the Department of Agriculture, no one remembers this account ever being active. So this was pre-ORS. So it's been at least 60 years that language has been in the statutes, and I don't know why it was enacted.
Follow up, is there any money in there?
Senator Olson, we have not been able to find anybody who knows where this account is. And we've checked with OSU, we've checked with our folks. It's a phantom.
I was going to say, maybe Senator Hansel knows because he had a uncle that used to be here. Maybe... Did your family have anything to do with the senator?
With gorse? No.
No, the Gorse Control Act.
Probably hidden out in his district or something.
I was just going to say, as a former chair of the State Noxious Weed Board, we've dealt with gorse for decades. And one time we looked at biocontrols, and we had a member of the gorse spider mite that had all sorts of possibility, and we found out a native spider ate the gorse spider mite, so that didn't go anywhere. But I think it was brought in because the guy was from Ireland and he thought this looked like Ireland without gorse. It wasn't really Ireland, so he brought it in so he would remind him of home. And
I thought it was Scott. Isn't that what they call it, Scott's broom? I thought, or
that's
no?
A different plant.
It's different. Okay.
Yeah. That real sticky.
Yeah. Here, we'll send you around a picture. I brought it up on my phone so everyone can see what it looks like. But it looks pretty yellow, but it's a nasty plant.
Yeah.
Well, I think Senator Hansel might, even though we don't have a work session scheduled, but we might have to have him carry it since he's
I'd be honored
had a long
to.
History with Gores.
Well, this whole cleanup, I am very supportive of it, having served on the front lines, I guess, of trying to combat these invasive species. And we've got a good program, and I think this helps focus what the state's about and cleans it up.
And I know that we're working hard to find some funding for the weed programs in the Ways and Means Subcommittee as well to help make sure we have money to work on eradicating gores.
Sure, Dinkfelter.
Yeah.
Lisa, how are we doing on aquatic invasive species? Are we still okay?
We actually have a whole presentation right after this. If you look on the agenda from Lisa DuBrevere.
You can't go any higher than her. So.
Yeah, it does. Anyway, Lisa, if you wanted to say, but we do have Lisa DuBrevere here this afternoon.
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I will defer to Lisa Deborah Kerr in her presentation because I'm sure you're going to hear a lot about weeds.
That's exactly right.
I assume that includes bass.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing this forward, and I agree, concur with Senator Hansel. I know you've been working on this for a while to clean these up, and I'm pleased to see that. And I don't see that there will be any issues with this, but we'll see if there's any. Other testimony.
Thank you. Get the job done. That's why he's a senator.
Right. Okay. Anybody else that would like to testify in House Bill 2247? Gorse is going once, twice. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2247. Or the work session, but we are missing. Okay, so we are waiting for Representative McLean, who would like to present his bill, House Bill 3199A. Did you give them a call?
We're calling.
Okay. So what I would prefer to do is the work sessions.
Yeah,
do you know where Senator Hass is?
Well,
we're going to be in recess here for just a minute. Yes, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3199A.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3199A establishes that a person commits a Class A violation if during a fire season declared for Forest Protection District or part of district, the person releases a sky lantern or discharges exploding target or tracer ammunition on land inside district or within 1/8 mile of the district, or if the sky lantern released by the person crosses above land inside district or within 1/8 mile of the district.
Okay, we have Peter Lee, is it Paul Bell and Tom Fields you want, and Matt Domit, all four of you, come on up. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Paul, are you kicking this off?
I can.
Okay, you can tell us why this bill is.
Kick it off.
Sure. Tell us why this bill is before us and what problem it's trying to solve.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairwoman Dingfelder and members of the committee. Us two were students at Willamette University, and we've been working with them on House Bill 3199.
Yeah, can you state your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm Peter Lee.
Okay.
And we are students at Willamette University, and we've been working on this.
Great.
Bill.
We're always happy to have you come across the street and come on over.
Well, it's a pleasure coming over here. Thank you, ma'am. And it's an effective way to protect Oregon's forest land from human-caused fire. The intent of this bill is to come up with a simple and effective method to help reduce human-caused threats of wildfire on forest land under Oregon protection. And it's to limit use of items that can transfer heat to fuel that can cause fire to trees, especially during a high fire risk period. The bill is specifically targeting sky lanterns, exploding targets, and tracer ammunition. Currently, there is a bill that has a restriction on the use of these during fire season, but it's not implemented statewide. It's implemented county by county, but we're trying to expand it to become a harmonized restriction. The first goal is to reduce the threat of fire by reducing behavior that leads to causing fire. The second goal is to harmonize statewide rules, and the third goal is to provide uniform, unambiguous definition for these items for the Oregon Department of Forestry as it attempts to regulate use of those. And my partner will talk about the history of this.
Okay, great. And then we have Rep. McLean, so I'll ask maybe one of you if you can step back. We'll have Rep. McLean come on up. But why don't you go ahead and finish up your testimony and state your name for the record, please, and thanks for coming across the street.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. We first...
And your name?
Oh, sorry, Matt Domet.
Okay, thanks, Matt.
And again, we're both students at Willamette University, and we've been working on this bill since it was a white sheet of paper in January. And so it's kind of been our baby. This was originally brought up to our attention by members of the OFIC and ODF as this is flammable items in forests are one of the leading causes of human-caused fires in Oregon, and particularly recreational items. And so this was brought to our attention. Since 2007, there have been 35 fire starts from recreational shooting-related activities, and I believe that our friend from ODF can help us if I get any of my stats wrong. These included in 2007 the 1500 Road Fire, which burned 300 acres and cost the state $1.4 million in suppression costs alone. And that was started by tracer ammunition. And then just this last September, there was the Carpenterville Road Fire, which cost $20,000 in just suppression costs alone, not counting the damage caused to the trees. And that was started by exploding targets. Thankfully, as far as sky lanterns go, they're a relatively new phenomenon in Oregon, but they are gaining popularity, and it's kind of one of those things where it's only a matter of time until a fire gets started by one of those, especially with this coming summer wedding season. They're popular at weddings. And it's just a risk for if one of these flame-powered lanterns lands in a tree, then it can cause a crown fire, which can spread quickly. And so we urge your support, and we would be happy to answer any questions that we're capable of answering after everyone else has a chance
to speak. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. We appreciate you working on this, and I'm sure there may be some questions, but we have Representative McLean, who I know has a busy schedule, so we appreciate you coming over. And I think I'm sorry we missed the introduction we had. We recessed, and we were trying to track you down. So thanks for coming over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And to members of the committee, my name is Mike McLean. I'm the state representative for House District 55. And I commend the gentleman sitting next to my right who are living the ABC School Rock. I'm just a bill, and but I won't sing it now, although it's in my head going over and over. But the point is they had a great idea, and because we have a problem, east side forests have a problem in that we hit certain times where fire districts are imposed. In essence, people are asked not to be burning fires in the forest, and they even have anti-smoking rules at some campgrounds. My district suffered some of the worst fires we've had in a long time in 2012. And in 2000, part of the time, I think it was 2005, a human-caused fire in Wheeler County destroyed several thousand acres of timber and rangelands, and it's very hard for owners of that property to recoup their losses. So one simple solution is to, when we have identified something like the sky lanterns, or exploding bullets, to restrict them in these areas, as with other things are restricted, so we don't have areas in the law which are unclear. And I know that most folks who are at weddings, and where these are used a lot, the sky lanterns, and they're celebrating, you know, the event, that it's not their intention to cause fires. But fires east of the mountains spread very quickly and can lead to catastrophic loss, and the fire suppression cost hits the millions, as I know you know, Madam Chair, because you and I have sat on the Ways and Means on stuff like that. So that's why we brought the bill, and it passed the House, and I think it's a good bill, and it's something that the law students have undertaken and have done a yeoman's work on it.
Great. Thank you. Actually, I do have a question, and maybe while you're here, Representative, before you, I'm sure you're going to have to run back to the House, but was there discussion about enforcement and also education? In other words, is it, because we're not prohibiting the sale of these, it's just the time of use. So I don't know if you thought about that as part of your looking into this, is the best way to educate people about usage. Enforcement obviously is going to be an issue, and I see that we have a violation in here, but that's going to be after the fact, obviously. So we want to prevent folks from doing it. So do any of you have any thoughts about educating the public,
Madam
on
Chair,
this?
You know, that's a very good point. I don't believe there was a lot talked about as far as education. I think that's something that the forestry department, when they do the in-school education programs that they do with Smokey the Bear and other things, they're going to have to bring up this. I don't know if you recall any specifics on the education program. I think enforcement is clearly, unfortunately, the private right of action for people who cause fire is still one of the only avenues of financial recovery, and is certainly more of a financial hit and thus deterrence. But enforcement beyond a violation is difficult when it comes to this, and I don't think anyone brought up the ban of the sale. It was just more the use of it in this time. Did they bring up education at all?
Mr. Fields might be able to better answer it, but we did discuss it a little bit with, as far as, you know, postings, having these items being specifically listed and that kind of thing, and then also in the fire prevention literature that comes out during fire season from the department. And so Tom can correct me if I'm wrong, but those were the avenues that we were looking at.
Well, just Department of Forest, we have your testimony, which I know you're not going to read. So do you want to comment on that? That's the biggest question I have, is the enforcement piece for ODF. Assuming also the sheriff would be involved as well, if the county sheriff, if there was a violation. I see the state fire marshal, Department of Forestry, and state forester, but I would imagine also if the sheriff was out there and would be enforcing as well.
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Fields. I'm the Fire Prevention Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Forestry. As far as education goes, and during this session today, I will be happy to provide support testimony in just a few minutes as well. But to answer your question, when fire season goes into effect, we typically put out several educational messages through mass media, social media, as well as in civic groups, fire prevention programs within the schools that are appropriate for that age level. So if and when this passes through the legislature, it is our intent to heavily educate the public on what we are trying to achieve here. But outside of that, these activities can be prohibited district by district through what we call a regulated use closure. That's only a district by district case, however. So by getting this legislation passed, we're hitting things across the board so that it is prohibited in all areas protected by Department of Forestry.
Okay, and follow-up would be where the, I didn't hear about retailers where these are being sold. So I would imagine you would also educate folks about, that's probably the best place is point of sale.
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. We generally work through our district offices around the state to provide educational materials at retailers where these are being sold. So flyers, information for the retailers themselves on the dangers of these items that pose a threat to our forests.
Okay. Any questions for the representative or either the students before we let them go? Senator Olson, Senator
just to be,
Bates.
Just to be clear, this covers federal forest land also?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, no, this legislation is only on lands protected by the Department of Forestry, 16 million acres of which is private county state BLM lands on the west side of the Cascades. Those are the primary lands we're looking at with this legislation.
So it does, to answer your question, it does include some federal but not all federal lands. It's whatever our forest program covers, correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator Bates?
Yeah, I had a couple questions about these sky lanterns. They look pretty cool when you see them on TV, but as a, somebody has a farm, it makes me nervous. The next-door neighbors lighting these things off at any time of the year, catching a barn on fire, a house on fire. And just during fire season isn't necessarily the best, you know, the only time it's dangerous. Our fire season's closed down usually in October, depending on the weather. And you have a dry spell after that. Has there been any discussion about banning these except allowing them in specific areas and having a statewide ban? Some states, I think, have banned these, I seem to remember, as just too dangerous and only allow them probably in really specific areas. Was there any discussion about that?
There, and it says on your handout that four states have banned this, banned them. So I concur. Was there any discussion about an outright ban?
Yes. Senator Dingfelder, Senator Bates. Yes, we did think about that. But when we originally started with our idea, it started out as a forestry bill. And so in order to stay, pardon me, in order to stay within our relating clause for our, our note for mother, we had to keep it within the forestry realm.
Well, all questions?
Follow up?
First, if we got the jargon, I'm pretty good.
Sorry.
It's okay. And the land covered, is that, I didn't quite hear, does that cover private land also?
Yeah.
What about private land that's not being used as forest land right now? Just you have some oaks or pine or something on your property. Does it cover that?
Well, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, anywhere where the Department of Forestry would have jurisdiction, it would apply. So it would apply to private lands where there is timber of amount acreage. Is it, what's the minimum?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, my understanding is, and we do have Paul Bell with us today from Department of Forestry as well, but as far as forest land is concerned and the definition that includes private land, it is, in a nutshell, land that will carry fire. Agricultural land, some agricultural land is exempt from that, but we're talking primarily grazing and timberlands protected by Department of Forestry.
Just a comment. Great bill. Glad they brought it forward. I think, you know, we may gain knowledge, unfortunately, the hard way in the future. We may need to go further in this. This is a state that's got a lot of trees in it, a lot of grass in it. We have dry seasons, and you can really light a place up. And I've had some personal experience with neighbors not being careful. And I'll tell you what, you can lose a lot fast. You know, you can lose a hay field. You can lose a lot of other stuff real quick, too. So good job. And I guess the other comment is I think this is a gun bill we can all agree on.
I'm not sure I heard that, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, but you, as soon as you said that word gun bill, I got nervous.
I guess it's a gun bill we all can agree on.
Oh, in that regard. Yes, the Senator Bates.
He was going to stuff your bill. Oh, never mind.
Yeah. But
That makes me very nervous. But the
the relating clause is too narrow.
Fortunately, the one thing I would comment is we do have a pro-plaintiff's timber trespass statute, which allows double damages if you have a fire that escapes, if you intentionally do it. But if you negligently do it, still double damages with attorney's fees. So there's a pretty stiff deterrence from a civil level. And so I think what this does is it, if someone may use may be in violation and use this lantern, what it does is it really opens the door for the civil lawsuits to where the consequence of misuse of the sky lanterns or the igniting ammunition are so severe that our hope is that that's a sufficient deterrent. I'm not in favor of bans unless there's evidence to show that it really needs it, but and it may be that we have to come back and
Good start, though.
Yeah, I concur. I think the question for me is, you know, how much these are being used, and if we see a proliferation of these. And I concur as far as the civil, penalties, and of course with the liability. But I'm not sure when people are using that they're necessarily thinking of that, as we know. And of course, we want to try to prevent the forest fires from happening because the damages are huge, and not just financial, but you know, there's lots of other costs to the community.
Madam Chair, for the students, are you guys getting graded on this project?
Yes, we are.
We're hoping for an A, so you guys can help us out with that.
If it passes, then it's an A.
Well, we should make sure that Senator Olson is not carrying the bill then to the floor.
Good luck with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. Are there any other questions before we let these students off the hook and Representative McLean? And did you want to add to that the answer?
Madam Chair, if I could just briefly say that that all of these items have gained popularity just in recent years, and it's not just Oregon, but several other states here in the region. And as far as the use of sky lanterns, I was first introduced to that by going to an animated film with my daughter and seeing thousands of sky lanterns go up in the air as part of the film. So it was a little disconcerting to me, sitting in the theater as a fire prevention coordinator, watching this unfold before my eyes.
Wow.
And my 12-year-old daughter heard me gasp and had to calm my nerves a little bit at that time. So, again, I support, from the Department of Forestry, we support this bill and what these fine young gentlemen have brought before you, and urge for your support as well.
Great.
So thank you.
Thank you. And who knows, Senator Bates may be putting in a bill next session. So, and what year, I should have asked, what year in law school are you in?
We're first-year students.
Oh, there you go. You've got a couple more years to work on this.
Yeah, just finished our first year on Friday.
That's very impressive. Not many law students, especially in their first year, get to say that they've actually worked on making laws. You have a practicing lawyer next to you. He was talking a lot about civil lawsuits and all that sort of stuff.
All the good stuff.
Madam Chair, anytime a lawyer says they practice, makes me nervous.
We want them to practice.
Well, we'll get better after time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you very much for bringing it forward. Thank you, Representative McLean.
Thank you,
McLean.
Yeah, we never quite get it.
We have a few more folks that would like to testify on this. And, Paul, did you want to say anything in addition? We have your written testimony.
Nothing more to add.
We have Heath from the Oregon Forest Industries Council and Roger Beyer. And anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 3199A?
I'm actually going over to Mitchell.
All right, gentlemen.
Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Our members own and manage approximately 5 million acres in the state of Oregon. When the Willamette Law students approached us about a potential project, it seemed like this was a natural fit, and they were excited about pursuing the effort. Our members face real risk, and what's interesting about the devices in this bill, that is the luminaries, the sky lanterns, exploding targets, and tracer ammunition, is that while these have all been around for a long time, their use is escalating, is picking up. It's becoming a lot more popular lately. We're very excited about preventing any mechanism of preventing or controlling the use of these devices on forest lands during fire season. Senator and Senator Bates, to your questions earlier, we too are worried about, you know, how do people know about this law, and how do you make sure that they respond? And a couple comments to that. One is, I suspect that it will only take a couple of enforcement actions before the word starts getting out. Two, if you're out on forest lands and you're a forest land owner, for instance, who houses, you know, like shooting ranges, that's pretty common. It's nice to be able to put up signs and tell people that, look, these devices are outlawed during fire season, and there's actually legal repercussions for doing so. And three, I would say that it occurs to us that this might be exactly the kind of thing you would want to put a flyer in the hunting synopsis with Fish and Wildlife, right? And that's the kind of thing these folks read, and the hope is that they would see it. But to your point, Senator Dingfelder, we are very interested in preventing the fires before they start, not just tagging them with a violation after the fact. Our hope is that this bill would accomplish that end, and in that light, we urge your support.
Thank you.
Roger? Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and we are also in support of this bill. I'd like to take that hat off just for a moment and put on a hat that I wear in my private life, also as a board of directors for the Clackamas Marion Forest Patrol Association. And around the state of Oregon, we have a unique system of fire protection and fire prevention, and each area of the state has local districts, local boards that help the Department of Forestry, the local area, on how they're going to, you know, do what they're going to do in the districts and how they're going to prevent fire. So I think this, in the education side of it, this would be a good role for the local forest patrol associations, and also they work very closely and help fund Keep Oregon Green. So I can see the natural fit here on this issue for Keep Oregon Green to help get the word out through these local donations from the local districts. So with that, I think everything else about the bill has been said. We're very interested in protecting our forest lands along with those of our neighbors from the industry and BLM and the state forests and other public forests. So with that, I'd urge an aye vote and happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen?
I just have a,
Senator Hansel.
You know, looking at this picture that we were handed, I guess it raises a question, because I know during World War II we had incendiary floating as a weapon of war to light things on fire. Do these things go out? I mean, whether or not it's fire season, if it comes down somebody's roof, or like Senator Bates said, their haystack or their field or log pile or whatever. I mean, what we're sending up, it almost like we're, do you know anything about the sky lanterns? Are they supposed to go out someplace up in the atmosphere and fall, or what?
Go ahead, I've never seen one.
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Hansel. So the idea, generally, the theory is, right, that as long as the source of heat is alive, that it'll stay aloft, right? And it's only after that's out that the device will descend. Unfortunately, that's all too often untrue. That's not a very good way to keep these devices in the air. Wind or any number of other things have a way of putting them on the ground. But to your point, I would say, the shocking part about this bill, I find, is that it's necessary in the first instance. What a terrible, terrible idea to light something on fire and release it uncontrolled over other people's lands, even over your own lands. It's unfortunate that this bill is necessary, but we believe it is, and it addresses an increasingly important issue in Oregon.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. And anybody else would like to testify on House Bill 3199A? Okay, seeing none, we will go ahead and close the public hearing. And we don't have work sessions scheduled on any of these bills today, but check the agendas for the future. Okay, we are going to, before we hear the update on Invasive Species Council, we have a couple work sessions scheduled. I will go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2105A, and Beth, if you can remind us about that bill we heard last week.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2105A has no revenue, and a fiscal statement was issued on this bill. The bill requires the Department of Energy to study and report on issues relating to the Energy Facility Siting Council by November 1st, 2013.
Okay, and also, do you want to mention about, did you mention about the fiscal?
I did mention that there is a fiscal statement that's in your packets in the and on OLIS as well.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we are in work session. I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2105A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves House Bill 2105A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this bill? Okay. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Staff, the motion carries. And Senator Hansel, I was wondering, since you probably have more energy facilities in your district than probably any of us here, if you would be interested in carrying this.
Sure.
Okay. Great. And as a former county commissioner, you understand the process probably than a lot of us here. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2105A, and Senator Hansel is the carrier. Okay, I will go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3448. No A.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3448 in front of you exempts diesel fuel sold to facilities that store more than 50 gallons of diesel fuel for emergency power generation from the requirement to contain a certain percentage of biodiesel or other diesel with a renewable component. There was a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. No statement issued on this bill.
Okay. I will accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3448 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator also moves House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator Hatch.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Aye. With that, the motion carries. And Senator Bates, since you are frequently involved with hospitals, mm-hmm. is this something that you would like to carry?
I'd be glad to.
Okay. And backup generators, I should say. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 3448. We're done with our official work sessions today, but we have a very much awaited update on the Invasive Species Council. We've had quite a bit of discussions in this committee on invasive species over the past. We've asked Lisa Dubricare, who's the coordinator of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, to provide us with an update. And thank you for coming here today, Lisa. I know you've been very busy, and appreciate you making time to come update the committee.
You bet. Well, for the record, my name is Lisa Dubricare. I'm the coordinator of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, and I'm here today to give you a brief overview of some of the things that we've been up to in the status of the council. First, I want to thank Senator Dingfelder and Senator Hansel and all the rest of you that have supported invasive species legislation in the past. During the past two legislative sessions, we've passed 15 invasive species-related bills, which have done a great deal in terms of helping us advance protection for the state of Oregon. I also want to note that I am not an invasive species expert. My job as the coordinator is to help make things happen for people that are indeed the experts, and those are the folks with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and Portland State University and other organizations that are part of our council. But I'll do my best to answer your questions. I thought I'd just give you a couple of brief snippets on in five different areas that we work in relative to coordination and collaboration, outreach, prevention, funding, and legislative issues, and see if you might have any questions about it. When people think of our council, they often think of us as in the state of Oregon, but in fact, a lot of the work we do is done regionally and nationally, so our borders go far beyond our state. As an example of that, we co-led a workshop in Phoenix, Arizona in August of 2012. We worked with Assistant Attorneys General, law enforcement supervisors, and policymakers to see if we could help advance some regulatory actions relative to the movement of aquatic invasive species with watercraft, i.e. quagga and zebra mussels. So we were very instrumental in helping to facilitate that meeting with many of the western states, and one outcome of that was the production of an action plan for which all of the western states are contributing to see if we can develop some cohesive regulatory mechanisms, because it's different things are happening in different states. We recently coordinated a letter of support to the City of Portland. The City of Portland is recognized nationally as having one of the best invasive species programs in any municipality in the United States. That program is on the chopping block, and so we coordinated a letter of support with over 40 organizations in the state of Oregon, asking the City Council members to support that funding. Another example of something we're doing is on May 15th, we're working with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, and the Northwest Power and Conservation Council to host a workshop in Vancouver, Washington, to see if we can come together as a region to best protect the Pacific Northwest from quagga and zebra mussels. What's happening right now, for example, is that the state of Idaho is putting over $1 million into boat inspection stations all around its border, and Oregon's putting boat inspection stations around its border, but we don't have quagga and zebra mussels in the Pacific Northwest. So if Washington, Oregon, and Idaho get together and pool their resources and just have boat inspection stations on the perimeter of those three states, we can save a lot of money, work together cooperatively, and protect all three states for far less than what we would spend from any one state. So that's an example of the kind of coordination collaboration that we're trying to do. Every other year, we also host a summit in the fall of the year in preparation for an upcoming legislative session to see if we can address any shortcomings or gaps in invasive species legislation. A couple of examples of outreach that we do. We hosted a tri-state outreach campaign with Washington and Idaho called Buy It Where You Burn It. It was a way to protect Oregon from the transport of invasive pests on firewood. And we, as a result of that campaign, Oregon passed legislation during the last legislative session.
Senator Olson carried that, didn't you?
Yes, sir, you did. Thank you very much. And that bill prevents the transport or movement or import of firewood into this state from any state other than the Pacific Northwest unless that firewood has been heat treated. We've been spending a great deal of time now working with firewood vendors and distributors to ensure that the products on the shelves do indeed meet Oregon's law. In addition to that, we launched a campaign called Squeal on Pigs. It's a tri-state campaign with Washington and Idaho on feral swine. Feral swine is a tremendous threat to the Pacific Northwest. It's a species of animal that is now running rampant in many states in this country, including specifically in the South and the Midwest, and it is in California as well. We do not want feral swine in this state. They carry every one of the major osis diseases known to man, brucellosis, tuberculosis, all of the osis diseases, including pseudorabies and foot and mouth disease. So it's a tremendous threat to agriculture to have that species in our state. Just last week, we killed 52 pigs with USDA APHIS Wildlife Services and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So we've got a tri-state hotline. If anybody suspects they've seen a feral swine, they can call a free hotline number, and USDA APHIS and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife immediately responds.
We did have the feral pig bill as well. I think we've had them all in here.
You've had them all.
Yes.
Where did you kill the pigs at?
In the Madras area.
Really?
Yep.
And if you've never seen what landscape looks like after a herd of feral pigs come in, it's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. It's like rototilling. We're also working very closely with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, so we worked collectively with our Canadian province partners and the Western states to develop seven messages that we want to share with the public about invasive species. This saves the states and Canadian provinces a lot of money when we collectively come together and prioritize issues in messages in messaging with the public. We are building a new invasive species website for the state of Oregon. We've gotten together with a lot of our partners. Many of the people in the public get confused about invasive species because there's so much information in different places and some of it is conflicting. So we've agreed to lead an effort and have a new Invasive Species Council website that pulls in invasive species information from our partners, links to our partners, and provides essentially one-stop shopping for people relative to invasive species. It will have a strong early detection rapid response network component.
Lisa, can I ask a quick question on that point,
yes, ma'am,
which is connection to the weed boards? Because that was one of the questions, and the weed boards have been around for a long time, and then the Invasive Species Council developed. And so can you, or Is there going to be connection? I should probably ask ODA as we're looking at funding, because this has come up, is how are the weed boards interacting with the Invasive Species Council? I understand that Invasive Species Council is sort of advisory and the weed boards are on the ground doing the work, but maybe you can briefly touch upon that.
Sure. So we actually just recently conducted a statewide survey to see if anybody that does work on invasive species feels like there's replication or overlap, and over 90% responded that no, there wasn't. The weed board, which was led by Senator Hansel for quite some time, has a very specific role, particularly relative to noxious weeds. The cooperative weed management areas play a very strong particular role on the ground, doing on-the-ground management. Watershed councils have another role, so everybody has these different roles, and the role of the Invasive Species Council is indeed advisory. And a strong coordination and convening function to ensure there isn't overlap.
Well, that's good to hear.
The other thing I wanted to mention was relative to legislation. We are supporting Senate Bill 571, which adds the Oregon Marine Board to our council. That's a very important move for the council. The Marine Board works very closely with us. Aquatic invasive species is a huge concern to the state of Oregon, and we hope that bill does indeed pass and that they become a long-term ex officio member of our council. We were integral in the development of language for a new integrated pest management bill, which is working its way through the legislature as we speak. And as I mentioned, we are putting a significant effort on ensuring that legislation that has been passed relative to invasive species has the adequate amount of outreach with the public to ensure people understand. The last piece I wanted to share with you is sort of a prevention funding piece to talk about where the council is in both of those arenas. The first is IMAP Invasives. The Oregon Invasive Species Council sponsored IMAP Invasives for the state. It's a place where anybody in the state can go and report a suspected sighting of an invasive species. We now have over 300,000 sightings in the state. It's the largest database of its kind for a state in IMAP Invasives in the United States. And other states are looking at Oregon as a model for that because of how many reported sightings that we have and how people are using those sightings to share information with one another about control and treatment of those species. The council also manages a reporting hotline, an online hotline for people to report suspected sightings. And since we started managing that with Oregon Public Broadcasting 4 years ago, we've had almost 1,200 reports come into that hotline. And folks like people at the Oregon Department of Agriculture respond to those sightings when they come in, particularly if it's for A-rated species. Oregon is in its fourth year of its aquatic invasive species permit implementation. That bill was passed in 2009 with a supporting bill that was passed in 2011 that made boat inspection stations mandatory. In 2012, boat inspection stations were moved to the eastern and southern portions of the state of Oregon. They conducted 4,675 watercraft inspections in 2012. They decontaminated 51 watercraft. 18 of them had quagga and zebra mussels on them. Roadside inspection compliance was at 70%. We anticipate that's going to get much higher now as we continue to receive assistance from law enforcement. In terms of funding, we are facing very significant challenges in this state and in this country relative to funding for invasive species. We are all cognizant of the state of Oregon's budget. We are all cognizant of the importance of health, education, care for the elderly, and all of those things that matter to all of us as citizens in the state of Oregon. And what we are going to do about natural resource funding is quite a dilemma, not only for the natural resource agencies, but for invasive species in particular. Our council operates on a $15,000 biannual operating budget. We did not receive any funding during the last legislative session. We are hoping we get that $15,000 back this biennium. In addition to that, we used to receive one-third of an FTE funding for a contract coordinator. We did not receive that last biennium. We hope to have that put back into our fiscal agent's budget this biennium, and our fiscal agent is the Oregon Department of Agriculture. A bill passed during the last legislative session that creates a framework to fund county weed management programs. weed districts. The legislature passed the framework. What we didn't have was the funding to make that a reality. The funding doesn't exist now. It's not going to exist, to our knowledge, in this legislative session. We didn't even ask for it, given the status of Oregon's budget. But it's something that we need to think about long-term, sustainable funding for invasive species. But I also want to share with you some things that are happening at a federal level, too, that are affecting how Oregon's ability to deal with invasive pests. The Animal Plant Health Inspection Service is receiving cuts to their budget, and their budget funds a lot of the pest work that the Oregon Department of Agriculture does. ODA only received one-third of their requested budget for gypsy moth detection surveys this past year. If we don't survey and monitor for invasive species, what happens is we find large infestations. And when we find those large infestations, we end up having to spray a lot of chemicals, and it costs us a lot of money. So we know that for every dollar we spend in prevention, we save $35 in what we would ultimately have to pay down the road. This year, the pest detection line item for the Oregon Department of Agriculture for pest surveys was reduced 8%, and more cuts to our invasive species federal survey funds are expected. There is no more noxious weed survey funding through the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. So all of this good work that we've been doing with gypsy moths and Japanese beetles and some of these species that potentially threaten over 30 million acres of Oregon's forests and our nursery industry and other things like that, we are wondering where a lot of that funding is going to come from in the future. So we sat down as a council and said, what can we do to help with this situation? And what we are doing to tee up the 2015 legislative session is we have convened a number of our stakeholders and our council members and our partner organizations, and we are developing a long-term sustainable funding strategy for the state of Oregon for invasive species. We're looking at vectors and pathways, how these species are coming into this state, whether it's modes of commerce or recreation or whatever it is, and we're looking at what those programs are costing to monitor species relative to those vectors and pathways. And we are going to propose to you a suite of options in the 2015 legislative session. I don't have any more details at this time. That's sort of a tickler announcement. But at some point, somebody has to do something. And so we are convening a lot of people. We're involving legislators in this conversation. When we're ready, and we're not quite ready yet to do that, and we hope to have something to present to you in 2015. That's pretty much where we're at, and if you'd like to hear more on any of those, I just tried to grab from different pieces of what we're doing.
Great. Thank you for that excellent update. I think there were – did that answer your question, Senator Olson?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions or comments for Lisa?
Just a quick thought.
Yeah.
You actually stopped a couple of boats that had mussels on them?
Yes, sir.
You're not a technical person, but where were they coming from? What's the likelihood of them, of others getting through? And do those mussels survive a long time out of water?
They came from Lake Mead. So the southern states that have some of these, Arizona has some of these water bodies that are infested. It's usually people that bring their boats down there for the winter and then bring them back up. We've been working very closely with Lake Mead to try to find sources of funds for them to decontaminate watercraft at the source, which is the smartest way to do any kind of a prevention program like that. Those animals can live outside of water for a significant period of time, up to several weeks. They literally close themselves up in their shells. It takes a high temperature, significant amount of water to remove them from a boat, and think about how they can get encrusted into ballast tanks and things like that, inside the engines of watercraft and that sort of thing. So it's a pretty significant process to decontaminate them. And we are working very hard at the regional level with a number of different groups to see what we can do to enhance protection.
Great. Senator Hansel?
I was just going to say that there, in answer to an earlier question, Mr. Dan Hilburn actually serves on the Weed Board and the Invasive Species Council. So there's a lot of leadership on both and keeps us working coordinated very well. And then a question, you know, Lisa, I appreciate what you do. You do a great job, and so does the Invasive Species Council. if some way, somehow in the budget, someone could find resources for your invasive species council, you probably wouldn't turn it down, right? Even though you didn't ask for it?
No, we wouldn't turn it down. But I want to emphasize, when we formed this council in 2001, when the legislature created it, and then we started talking about funding it, we always believed it would best be served by being one-third state-funded, one-third federal-funded, and one-third nonprofit or industry-funded. Because when people make that investment, it just makes for a better product coming out the other end of the pipe. No one ever wanted or envisioned this council to be fully funded by the state of Oregon. And to this day, and I think Dan would echo that, I'm not seeing in the back of my head if he's nodding, but we still would like to see that one-third, 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 because that makes sense for Oregon.
Well, and just to follow up on the senator's question is that, and Dan, maybe you can come up and address this, as far as are you seeing, you talked about the federal funding and concern about that. That's what I think Senator Hansel's getting at. If there's going to be a shortfall, especially with the sequester, I don't know if there's any impacts that you're seeing from that, Dan. And I know we're morphing into, we spent the early part of the afternoon hearing the policy option packages for Department of Ag's budget, but we didn't completely touch upon the Invasive Species Council. I probably missed a little bit of the weed board discussion, but...
Sure. Dan Hilburn, Oregon Department of Agriculture and member of the Invasive Species Council and State Weed Board. You're absolutely right. The federal government is having similar sorts of budget issues. The sequester has affected our programs. The grants that we normally get have been reduced. And the future outlook for things like gypsy moth, which we have a long history here, is that they're trying to get out of those programs. Most of the country already has gypsy moth. Same with sudden oak death. They're trying to get out of that. So we're a kind of an island here, where our environment is in a better shape than a lot of the rest of the country. So things matter to us more here than they do to the rest of the country. So it's a dilemma. And we really do need to find a better way to fund invasive species programs. I'm very excited about finding funding sources tied to the pathways and vectors that bring them here. To me, that makes sense, because as those pathways and vectors change over time, then presumably we'd have the funding to address what comes in via those pathways.
Well, I have two quick other questions. One is the permits, or the license, or whatever we're calling them, for the invasive species permits for boats now.
Aquatic invasive species permits.
So as far as does the council get some of that funding?
No. The funding from that goes directly to the Oregon Marine Board and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to conduct outreach, boat inspection stations, and training for watercraft decontamination.
So I guess that's a possibility, is to explore a small amount coming off and going to the Invasive Species Council, because the work that you're doing, Lisa, I mean, you know, I've been working on this issue here for a long time, and really things started happening a lot when we have a staffed council to make sure that coordination happens. It's really important, and I can't say enough positive things about the work that you've been doing. The other is, so I think that's something that we definitely need to explore. The other is, this came up when we were talking about Waldo Lake. I asked if seaplanes are required to have an invasive species permit, and I found out they are not. So I think we need to look into that, because, you know, we don't have a huge amount of seaplanes landing around the state, but they're going from water body to water body. So if you have any comments on that, I'd certainly appreciate your thoughts.
Madam Chair, we have been working with the seaplane associations in a number of states. They do a great job of informing their pilots on how to survey their boats and monitor for anything that might be growing on them. The great thing about seaplanes is a lot of times they aren't docked in any one infested place for a long period of time. It's a lot more like a kayak kind of a thing versus a boat that just stays, for example, in Lake Mead at any one time. In addition to that, because of the water chemistry work that was done by Mark Sitzma at Portland State University and his folks, we know that places like Waldo Lake aren't very hospitable to aquatic invasive species, because the water chemistry in that lake is so pure. So we're working this thing from two angles. But one of the big things we did was get a lot of information on seaplane websites in the Pacific Northwest that provides for decontamination protocols and that sort of thing.
Well, and just to follow up, not to beat a dead horse, but they still are water crafts that are going around from water body to water body, like a kayak. And it may not, and kayaks are required if they're over a certain length. I know because my kayak was required because it's over a certain length to get the permit. So I think it's something we should look into. Certainly, you know, I'm sure that they'd be happy to, only $10, you know, it's not a big fee, but making sure that we are including all the watercraft in this program.
We will look into that.
Right.
Senator? I do one more. I know this isn't Ways and Means, so I'm just curious on your budget. Thank you for the update, and I like an update. Your ideal was a third.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that in your current budgeting process? Are we pretty much on that? Are you getting a third from the state, the feds, and the private? I know
no,
the feds are.
No, sir. Senator Hansel, we did not receive any funding from the state in our the last biennium budget. And we've been trying to put it back into our fiscal agent's budget this biennium. And in the absence of state funding, our federal partners came to the table and provided two-thirds instead of one-third.
Well, I'll ask the department if you can follow up with the committee on that program and the funding situation. And certainly the Ways and Means members here might be particularly interested. We have three of us here.
Great.
Great. All right, any other questions or comments? Thank you for coming and providing that update.
Thank you.
I know you've been busy and traveling, and I also made a note for my staff in the fall when you have that. I know it's hard, especially for those of us who are working to attend those, but I think we will make sure that every committee member has an invitation to that invasive species summit, so if they would like to attend, they could.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you. And with that, I will close the informational meeting on invasive species. And Beth, anything else?
Your entire agenda, Madam Chair.
Great. And with that, we are adjourned.